So again, one time Prabhupada said, or wrote, I don't know, we've written our books in such a way that we expected that anybody who studied them carefully would learn Sanskrit. So just take the time to actually be conscious of the words. And we see many times we start to recognize words and we recognize case endings. Dvija, we all know is twice born. And so Dvijasya is of the twice born. So we'll probably see that case ending again and again. Krishnasya, like that. And it's interesting here we have Murdhanyam on the head and Murdhajam, hairs. So jam means to be birth, right? Birth, Murdhajam, born from the Murdha. So, and actually, if you look at it this time, because usually when you translate it, if you're going to translate it, you've got to start from the back. I think I mentioned this before. Like in English, we say Tom hit the ball, you know. But in German, the verb is at the end. So one teacher was pointing out to us, like, it will say, in Bremerhof and upstairs in a room to a man to a woman was talking about breakfast, or about eating. And so it goes on and on with all this stuff until finally at the end of everything, you know, somebody will give you the verb. So Sanskrit also has a different word order, so you have to make it sense out of it in our English thinking. You have to start at the back, but this time it comes pretty much straightforward. If we just read the word-by-word translations, just English, it says, Suta Goswami said, Arjuna, just at that time knowing it, of the Lord motive, thus by the sword, the jewel separated on the head of the twice-born with hairs. So, next page here. Krishna Peak, translation. Just then Arjuna could understand.
Can understand
the motive of the Lord.
The motive of the Lord.
By his equivocal orders. And thus with his sword. He severed both the hair and jewel. From the head of Ashvatthama. I'm pretty sure this. Our office here, our ashram, is right next to Medical Center Parkway, and we get four lanes of traffic, to this way, to that way, and all the cars are either gray or black. It's a few white. So I apologize for that kind of background noise, but I guess not overwhelming. I hope. Okay, Prabhupada's purport. Contradictory orders of different persons are impossible to carry out. Therefore, a compromise was selected by Arjuna by his sharp intelligence. And he separated the jewel from the head of Ashvatthama. So here's a nice point. You know, Arjuna had sharp intelligence. I always remember in the Bible, excuse me, there's one quotation where Jesus says, Lord Jesus, that in your heart you should have faith like little children, but in your heads you should be as clever as serpents. You know? So yes, the devotees, we should have sharp intelligence like that. You know? And then he understood the Lord's desire, and he separated the jewel from the head of Ashvatthama. Yeah, this also requires a pretty sharp accuracy with the sword too. I as I understand, basically it's just like we have teeth coming out of our gums, and the skin like makes accommodation so there's no blood leakage or anything else. And these are like little jewels, you know, things like that. But this kid was born or manifested very soon with a nice ruby or something like that, beautiful ruby. Kind of growing right out of his head like that, and I guess it grew to some kind of nice proportions. So wherever he would go, he didn't have to decorate his head with a jewel. He already had one there, like that. But of course, like, you know, dentists can separate the teeth from the jawbone. So Arjuna with his sword did that. This was as good as cutting off his head, and yet his life was saved for all practical purposes. Here Ashvatthama is indicated as twice born. Certainly he was twice born, but he fell down from his position, and therefore he was properly punished. The next verse. Vimucha rashana badham balam hatya hata prabham tejasa manina hinam shibaran nirayapayat. Ashvatthama had already lost his bodily luster due to infanticide, and now, moreover, having lost a jewel from his head, he lost even more strength. Thus he was unbound and driven out of the camp. Thus being insulted, the humiliated Ashvatthama was simultaneously killed and not killed by the intelligence of Lord Krishna and Arjuna. Vapanam dravinadanam stanam nirapanam tata eshahi brahma bhandunam vado nanyo sti dahika. Cutting the hair from his head, depriving him of his wealth, and driving him from his residence are the prescribed punishments for the relative of a brahmana. There is no injunction for killing the body. Yeah. So Prabhupada, we mentioned several times, in the chapter on disappearance of Bhishma Dev, chapter 9, there's two purports where Prabhupada gives this fantastic summary of all of Varnashram. Again, it should be printed as a separate little thing, a little summary. And in there he says that the brahmana is part of their varna is to give guidance to the kshatriyas how to execute things, and they should do this by taking instructions from scriptures such as the Manu Samhita and Parasara's Dharma Shastra. So again, we did this whole adventure of finding a copy of that at the University of California, and this had librarians researching, and we had to go deep into that. The basements of the library, and it's very good. It's available at our website, Jayarama. No, that's our esoteric website, our public website, our exoteric website, bhati.org, which is kind of like bhakti without the K. Yeah, bhat, it means light. bhat.org. If you go there and you look in the classical bookshelf, I think it's right there, you can download the PDF. It was translated something like 1896 when Prabhupada was born, and no other translation, as far as I know, has really showed up, because I guess it was such a good job, you know. And again, I've heard Prabhupada, after I read it, I've noticed Prabhupada citing it in terms of practical things when he was talking in room conversations and stuff like that. You know, the Parasara Dharma Shastra, Parasara Dharma Shastra. By Parashara Muni, father of Vyasadeva. So he talks about that. But actually what I'm thinking about now is actually not from that. He talks about these relationships. But Prabhupada also says Chanika Pandit can be taught in the Gurukul and stuff like that. So Chanika Pandit's also a very great source of this knowledge on how to deal in these practical things with devotees. Manu Samhita, Parashara's Dharma Shastra, Chanika Shlok, Hitopadesh, what's the other one? Pancha Tantra. And of course, the Bhagavatam we're seeing here is full of so many very practical stories about Daivi Varna Ashram. Because when we do that properly, then it's just so easy to see Krishna. You know, when we're properly situated in our ashrams and our varnas, so easy to see Krishna then, like that. You know, we thank all glories to ISKCON. Yeah. So, in Chanaka, he's talking about the advice to the king, And he said that some Brahmin is a rascal guy. You know, he's doing really bad things, you know, in the community like that. And someone like temple president or something, you know, or the king tries to rectify him properly, you know, but doesn't do it, and it's just, you know, everybody is, you know, this guy's going to cause so many problems for people in our community already, just horrible things, you know. So he, you know, so then Chanika Pandit says, he should tell him to go. His solution is he can, what's the word, ostracize him from the community, but he shouldn't deprive him of his possessions, and he shouldn't physically chastise him like that. But he can just tell him, you know, Prabhu, you're a Brahmin and everything else, but these things you've been doing in the last one, that's just it. You know, pack up your stuff, take your family members, and get out of my community. Like that, you know. So he can ostracize him from the community. But there, Chanika Pandit says he shouldn't deprive him of his possessions or physically chastise him. So I guess that's driving him from his residence. He can drive him from his residence. But here it says he can deprive him of his wealth. So there's some discussions over what's the right thing to do. You know? Okay, yeah, but then Chanika Pandit goes on, and he continues by saying, but he should never... But then he also says you can't kill him. Yeah. And I think also says he should never physically chastise him and take his possessions like that. You know? And he says the king should understand that an intelligent man with one idea can destroy his entire kingdom. You know, so the Kshatriya should always be respectful to the Brahmanas like that. So we begin to see like what these are real Brahmanas, and that's the intensity and gravity of the situation that Arjuna, you know, in some ways, just to not like... You see this in ISKCON too, and devotees get in administrative positions, have to chastise other devotees, and even a little mistake, you know, they get reaction. So it's a very, very great mercy to take up these positions rather than just to avoid the necessities of chastising devotees. But sometimes like this, it's necessary. So anyway, that's Arjuna's sharp intelligence and Krishna's sharp intelligence. He cut his hair. In this case, it says he's being more heavy than Chanika was. Maybe Chanika thought his students weren't so sharp. So he told him, "Hey, just drive the guy out of his house and let him keep his hair, let him keep his family members. Yeah, don't chastise him physically. Let him keep his possessions, but just, you know, get him out of your community." Okay. And then it goes on. Putra Shoka Tara Sarve Pandava Sahakrishnaya Svanang Mritanang Yakrityam Chakur Nirharanadikam. Thereafter, the sons of Pandu and Draupadi, overwhelmed with grief, performed the proper rituals for the dead body of their relatives. Pandava Saha Krishnaya. But it says Krishna? Ah, because Draupadi is also known as Krishna, right? Yeah, yeah. Thereafter, the sons of Pandu and Draupadi, overwhelmed with grief, performed the proper rituals for the dead bodies and relatives. So, this point's been coming up a lot. I'm hearing about this, how we think that, you know, once we join ISKCON, we'll have no problems. But we look at the whole example of these people who are supposed to be our role models, and they had nothing but problems like that. And you know, I would say kind of that the thing is that when we join ISKCON, it's not that we get free from problems, but the problems get more interesting. That's about the kind of difference like that. So, yeah, if you want a peaceful life, all these kind of things like that, then Krishna will give it to you, but you'll probably be stuck in the psychological and physical concept of life, and in the end, it's not possible to have peace, you know, because peace just means the relief from suffering. It's just without suffering, there's no peace in the material world. It's a duality. So in the end, you're going to have some suffering, so you'll feel peaceful and enjoy that when you're not suffering. You know? So here the Pandavas are suffering, you know, along with Draupadi, and they perform the proper rituals for the dead bodies of their relatives. We're in our own work right now, we're trying to write something finally, take all our years of work, lecturing, and put it into a written format. So we're not traveling probably all the way at least until January or something like that. You know? Things come up first. It seems the most important thing we should do first is Sankhya, because we have some good grasp on that. We've seen how we can explain it many times to professors and students like that, in terms of people like Carl Jung, Marshall McLuhan, other E.T. Hall, people who are appreciated and understood and have following in the West, different anthropologists and stuff, who do cross-cultural studies in perception, of cross-cultural studies in what is time, space. We did that before in a previous lecture. So we've been reading lots. We just finished reading Carl Jung's Analytical Psychology, its Theory and Practice, which is more popularly known as the Tavistock Lectures. And they were delivered in 1935 or something, 31, in England at the Tavistock Foundation, which still exists and still a popular place. And about 400 psychiatrists came, at least more, to hear Jung talking. And Prabhupada said, of all the guys in dialectical spiritualism, he said, of all of them, he seems to have the most intelligence. You know? So we do see many very practical things that how we understood this. And if you want to be a cook, okay, you've got to learn a lot of detailed knowledge. But if you want to be a psychologist for Krishna, okay, then you've got to learn a lot about how the mind works and things like that. And he says very much that you think it's just talking or this or that, and I don't even talk. They just roll up your sleeve. You take a Gorsundar psychiatrist, he said, basically, psychology is like a rich man's, luxury. Now, the social workers get some training, but it's just a little bit. And the real thing is, all this is produced by chemicals. Let's give them an antidepressant. Let's give them a depressant. Let's give them this and that. He said, it's very, what he wishes he could do something else, but that's the way the whole thing has gone to this point. So we can change that. And he says many times, it's obvious that the antidepressant is just like blowing on a boil. The person has real psychological problems, schizophrenia from very deep things that may very well be from a previous lifetime, not at all, or some very traumatic experiences. Devotees have gone through this. I know many times devotees have asked me, Maharaj, this and that, and I refer them to a trained psychologist, and they've gone through it. Both times I'm thinking of, there was childhood trauma and led to homosexual tendencies like that, and they dealt with it and it got cured, So Jung is saying that all these rituals, he said psychology has been and even remains, when 1935 was saying this, 31, the best form of psychotherapy. He said if somebody comes to me and gets a little together in their psychology and decides to become a Catholic, and he says, I'm not at all disturbed. He said these rituals and things like that were designed by people who were vastly intelligent. He traces a lot of the rituals in the Catholic Church back to previous rituals from, I can't remember the names now, which you know them if you hear them, but different European rituals about under the church, for example, there used to be, the churches were built on a grotto with a nice fountain underneath, what do you call it, a spring. Spring? Spring. Okay, so maybe in the forest was a beautiful place where water was coming out of the side of the hill and always keeping a very beautiful, clean place there, So then the temple was built right on that. Hey, how nice, And then as the Catholic Church developed, they just didn't have so many rituals. So they just adopted these and integrated them with their philosophy. And then as the Catholic Church expanded more, then the baptismal font, it wasn't a grotto anymore, but under the church. But it was just one place big enough maybe to take water and put it on the baby's head. And so many very important rituals. At the time of death, there are certain rituals which have a tremendous effect on the psychology, on the archetypal images, as he's calling them. And basically, this is where we have to do our work, because what we're saying is on the karma, that there are psychic mental structures that are affected when somebody dies. If that somebody happens to be a horse, we call it, and we do an ashramedha sacrifice, then there are big vibration in the psychic structure of the universe, and we can get good results by it, doing it properly. You know, and so now we can't do that. So these rituals of offering carrots to Krishna on the altar properly, or potatoes, or you know, chapatis, they do have an effect on the psychic structure of the universe, which can, you know, again, make it very, very simple to be Krishna conscious at that point. Of course, our rituals are for that purpose, not just to, like, try and deal with somebody who's died so they can go to Swarga, or we can deal with, you know, healing our psychic wounds, but that everybody has spiritual advancement from this, like that, you know. So all these rituals, and Hamahali Acharya has given to us at the current time, as far as I understand, neck beads and tilak were pretty, you know, pretty, what's the word, like, fixed requirement by Prabhupada and the Acharyas. There are many other kavachas, shields, you know, but these two, in the Kali Yuga especially, the tilak, in the current time, tilak and neck beads are very powerful, you know, means of protecting us like that. Okay, so one little bit more here. Okay. Then I had a couple thoughts then about this point about contradictory orders. That seems to be one of the biggest things, you know, in the whole section here. We kind of covered the rituals and the sharp intelligence, but a little bit, but here we have Mother Yashoda. We all know this story. She was, you know, churning Krishna's milk, and the servants had gone here and there busy. So she herself was, you know, churning. And it describes, you know, how picturesque and beautiful she was as she was doing this, like that. And then little Krishna came and saw all this and indicated to his mother that he would also, he was hungry and wanted to take some milk. So she put him on her lap and was refreshing him. But just then, the pot began to boil over on the milk. I had to look for that image a little bit. I saved it, I think. And so then, Mother Yashoda is faced with a dilemma. I think lemma means that which is below perception. Means perception. Subliminal means something below your level of perception. And a dilemma is she was perceiving two things at the same time. Her baby was burning with hunger, and her baby's milk was, you know, burning over on the stove, you know. Yeah. So how to deal with this, you know? And also Arjuna, you know, was being told by Krishna, kill him, and you shouldn't kill him, you know. So these contradictory orders are a big aspect of our lives in devotional service. So if we look at the verse in the Bhagavatam in the translation, and as far as I know, Prabhupada did these translations and purports at this point. Okay, 10.9.5. Mother Yashoda then embraced Krishna, allowed him to sit down on her lap, and began to look upon the face of the Lord with great love and affection. Yeah. Because of her intense affection, milk was flowing from her breast. When she saw that the milk pan on the oven was boiling over, she immediately left her son to take care of the overflowing milk. Although the child was not yet fully satisfied with drinking the milk of his mother's breast. And Prabhupada's purport. Everything in the household affairs of Mother Yashoda was meant for Krishna. I guess Nanda Maharaj was also meant for Krishna. one of her household items. Yeah. Although Krishna was drinking the breast milk of Mother Yashoda, when she saw that the milk pan in the kitchen was overflowing, she had to take care of it immediately. And thus she left her son, who then became very angry, not having been fully satisfied with drinking the milk of her breast. Sometimes one must take care of more than one item of important business for the same purpose. Therefore, Mother Yashoda was not unjust when she left her son to take care of the overflowing milk. I don't think it's here, but the Prabhupada says that in devotional service, one is always confronted with these, confronted with these different choices, about what to do. In our stage, maybe we're confronted between Maya and Krishna, and what to do, But even if you go back to Goloka, or you just go get a chance to go and stay in Vrindavan for a month, now you're in the spiritual world. Everything's happening is being controlled by Krishna. And so you'll be confronted with different chances to service. Prabhu, we're going to go to Radha Damodar today. You want to come with us? Prabhu, can you give class this morning? Yeah. Can you help make these garlands? So they're all bona fide service. None of those things is Maya in the Vrindavan temple. Yeah. But what's to do? Yeah. So Mother Yashoda is here an example of being faced with this. And Prabhupada says, on the platform of love and affection, it is the duty of the devotee to do one thing first and other things later. And I bold made this bold. The proper intuition by which to do this is given by Krishna. Intuition. And then Prabhupada says, quotes 10:10, Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam pritipurvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam jinamam upayantate. Of course, this is one of the four nutshell verses which you should all memorize. 10:8, 10:11. It's easy to remember because 10:8 is 108. 10:8 is 108. Yeah. So, of course, it means that for one who is constantly devoted in devotional service, I give the intelligence by which they can come to me. Yeah. So, Prabhupada continues. In Krishna consciousness, everything is dynamic. Aha. That, of course, matches up with Mother Imla's lecture yesterday about different kinds of management. Krishna guides a devotee in what to do first and what to do next on the platform of absolute truth. So looking at this, you can't go to Goloka unless you become a sannyasi first. So as I've heard Prabhupada said, I want all my disciples, grihasthas, ladies, children, to become Goswamis. So a very small child, can be Goswami. And whatever free will they have, they can very, very quickly start using it for Krishna in a very, very, practical, real sense like that. So they can engage all their senses, And so this, again, is the essence of Varnashram Dharma, is sannyas. That's the whole purpose of Varnashram, is to come to sannyas. So if you come to that level in any stage, grihastha, vanapras, anything, brahmachari level, you achieve the perfection. And all you're doing now is just refining your perfection. Vachovegam, manasakarodavegam. And then once we do that, what happens? Get the senses under control. Jitatmana prasantasya paramatma samahita. Jitatma. Once the mind is controlled, jitatmana prasantasya, you will be happy. Paramatma samahita. And you'll be in contact with the Paramatma. So how do I know if I'm in contact with the Paramatma? Are your senses under control? Or are you being influenced by your senses? Oh, yeah, okay. Mana prasanta. Are you happy? Are you satisfied in mind? Oh, no, I'm not. Okay. Yes, I am. So therefore, your choice is good. I'm not doing this because, I want some kind of mental gratification out of this, that people should notice what I did, or because really, I'm lusty here. But no, the senses are under control, mind is under control, and then I'm actually asking Krishna, what should I do? and so it looks like Krishna's such a rascal. He dictated to Mother Yashoda, you know, to go take care of the milk. Okay, so if he did, why did he do that? And then become angry about it. So I guess he also, you know, likes to pick a fight with people sometimes or whatever. Likes a good fight even in Goloka. You know, he can't have much of a fight in Goloka because, you know, it's not the material world. But he can have some kind of, I guess, create some kind of, you know, good fight, you know, with this and that. So he was having a good fight with his mother over what was being right. What does it mean to be a right mother, you know? So our thoughts, and I think Mother Irmela also made the same points yesterday. There she is, Mother Irmela there. And she was talking about this point, of course, in the broad aspect, not specifically just the pastime. And I give an example of Mother Yashoda. But she made nice points, and I like those about, you know, how this kind of government... So here's a nice picture. In America, is Uncle Sam. So at some point he came into American culture as kind of being like the personification of America. It's amazing. You know, people can't live without icons. So here he is. This is the United States of America. Just like that. And notice he's got kind of longer hair that, you know, there, you know. Yeah, let me make your duty clear, okay? So it's not like administration is we want to inspire people or this or that. And the point was that, you know, this is different kinds of ideas, but the Dharma is not like that. You know, for some people, I would say that, yeah, for some people it is. You know, Dharma is that, you know, that they need an Uncle Sam, but this is mostly for people in the mode of ignorance. In the mode of passion, then they need somebody to kind of, you know, bribe them. In the mode of goodness, then it's more like a friendly, cooperative relationship. There's duty involved. And Krishna doesn't want to have all the work of making all the decisions. No. I went ahead and looked in the Bible a little bit here and got some conceptions of the cosmic manifestation that Mataji was talking about, cosmic control. And what came up mostly was Jehovah's Witnesses. It's interesting, you do these searches, like, for example, look at your phone book in the yellow pages and just flip through and see how many pages are dedicated towards different kinds of services. You'll get some very surprising insights, you know, about what people are paying the money for most, and for looking at the yellow pages in terms of these things. Some very interesting things. Of course, it depends where you live, too. Like that. But anyway, YouTube came up. What's the other one? Google, whatever we use, came up. And here's the administration, you know. Jehovah is watching. Do you see Jehovah there? It's clouds, you know. It's columns. Yeah. Jehovah's in the background there. You can just see his eyeball kind of sticking out. He's a really big guy like that, you know. Even the angels there have to be like kind of like little, you know, what's the word, like an awe and veneration with the size of Jehovah. So this is one very common thing, is that there's an administrator, but he's just basically this really terrifying guy. So you can see it's for those in the mode of ignorance. Then down below is, I looked up judgment, and we've got the picture down below of the guy on his knees in an ordinary shirt with the angels on both sides with some kind of whacking device or something. And Jesus, I guess, maybe kind of plea for the guy. But here we got Jehovah as a person. He looks quite like, you know, Jesus, you know, God the Father. Yeah. But still, there's a lot of fog involved in this thing. Not really clear. It's not that everything is delightful and full of niceness, but kind of fog out the mundane aspect of things. And one thing about it is, we've got the judge down here, about to whack his hammer down, you know. But that's kind of one thing that happens too, is this general conception of management and God that, you know, Mataji was making about yesterday. It's that God doesn't do much until the judgment. Maybe he gives you a little hint here, a little hint there, and stuff, but he's not really like riding on the same airplane as you and all this kind of stuff. And then, so finally, then, okay, you got your chance, got this and that, okay, then now, whack, and then, you know, he's going to make his decision, you know. So, But you know, it's not all that way also. On the other side also, we see the Jehovah's Witnesses also have this conception of, you know, people with singing and doing kirtan, you know, with accordions and violins and guitars, and all the different races and nations and ages are together, and the atmosphere and the natural atmosphere is a friendly atmosphere. But if you notice, Jesus and Jehovah are not here in this picture. That happens quite a few times. You know? So you see, there's a certain level of what's going on. And Arjuna, of course, had a very, very personal relationship. You know, that's a whole now. Yeah, and so he made his decisions about what should be done, and right there with Krishna. We should do the same thing. We should. Now we're going to be with Krishna. You know, we got to have our deities. You know, Grihasthas have their deities. They have them on the altar. They carry them in a box. You know, Prabhupada says the god in the box. You know, they carry them wherever they go. Yeah. But then beyond that, a sannyasi, what does he do? Radha Krishna, how's it go? Nitya Seva, Nitya something. Radha Krishna Sarvada Sevibe. Balana Karibe Ara Balana Paribe Hridayate Radha Krishna Sarvada Sevibe. It's from Jagannatha Pandit. It's quoted in the beginning of Upadeshamrita. You've renounced everything. You know, don't even dream about the opposite sex. Yeah. And don't dally with them even in dreams. You know, see what Lord Chaitanya did to Chodaharidas. But rather, you should always dress simply and eat simply, and in your heart of hearts, worship Radha Krishna. This is the instruction Lord Chaitanya gave to Jagadananda. Not Jagadananda. Raghunath Das, when he was, of course, a young boy, how to execute sannyas. You know? So very nice instructions. And of course, anybody, again, you can be sannyasi, sannyasini. You know? Yeah? But this is the instruction. Prabhupada said a sannyasi is proud of always meditating on Radha and Krishna in his heart. And it can be in different ways. It can be meditating on the instructions, or it can also be, you know, spending time when you're chanting your rounds, of actually contemplating a certain form of Radha and Krishna, like that. You're in a more introspective ashram, or by nature you're more introspective. And so you very naturally, the facility is that you're Grihastha, the household deity, you have to leave him there sometimes, you know, or maybe you can take a picture in your wallet or your purse. But sannyasi has the facility, you can always remember his deity, you know, and be very happy to have his association and see his form, and then, you know, start developing some kind of very practical service relationship, which will allow him to see him all the time. And then these decisions, which apparently we're going to have to take quite often, these intuitive decisions, if we're going to really be devotees, we have to take so many intuitive decisions. In the case of Arjuna, it's not a small thing. You know, the case of somebody, okay, where's the Green Hornet or somebody, yeah. Arjuna's decision is whether, like, the sword should pass, you know, 2 inches of 5 inches above his head, you know, at head level, or 5 inches below his head. You know, he's got to make a life and death decision at this point. You know, and it's intuitive. Hey, it's not scripture; it's everything else. Not even the association of devotees, actually. So I think it's the one real strong lesson from all of this that we're learning, is that we should really get into this whole process of purification, and we should become Goswamis. We should be able to see Radha and Krishna and their association, make these very practical decisions as we go on through life. We also had some other stuff here on... Well, here's a nice poem. I'll just read this. Because it fits into Mataji's, you know... presentation here about ISKCON and management, and it points out what we have to be careful about. And I'm not criticizing the GBC here, like that. Don't say Hanumapari sucks while me criticize GBC. But it's a danger, and every GBC secretary, you know, sane consciousness knows this. This is by T.S. Eliot. The broad-backed hippopotamus rests on his belly in the mud. Although he seems so firm to us, he is merely flesh and blood. Flesh and blood is weak and frail, susceptible to nervous shock, while the true church can never fail, for it is based upon a rock. The hippo's feeble steps may err in compassing material ends, while the true church need never stir to gather in its dividends. The potamus can never reach the mango on the mango tree, but fruit of pomegranates and peach refresh the church from over the sea. At mating time, the hippo's voice betrays inflections hoarse and odd, but every week we hear rejoice the church at being one with God. The hippopotamus's day is passed in sleep, at night he hunts. God works in a mysterious way, the church can sleep and feed at once. I saw the potamus take wing, ascending from the damp savannas, inquiring angels round him sing the praise of God in loud hosannas. The blood of the Lamb shall wash him clean, in him shall heavenly arms enfold, and among the saints he shall be seen, performing on a harp of gold. He shall be washed as white as snow, by all the martyred virgins kissed, while the true church remains below, wrapped in old miasmal mist. Joy. Iskon ki joy. Yeah. Stupid, ordinary, sincere devotees, ki joy. So it kind of ends our insanity. Actually, I did have like a whole, kind of like reviewing a whole chapter before, because it's the end of the chapter. But there won't be time for that, I don't think. I'm missing this, looking over it. And then we look ahead, what's going to happen next. We'll see that Kunti and Yudhishthira will retain Krishna in this canto, the birth of Maharaj Parikshit, and the disappearance of Krishna and the Pandavas, the activities of Maharaj Parikshit, and finally the birth of Srimad Bhagavatam. So this first canto is a preface. And these are very important prefatorial incidents that really allow us to understand the circumstances under which Srimad Bhagavatam was being spoken like that. So, any questions, comments, complaints, anxieties?
Huh? I'm sure you have plenty of anxiety. Sorry, I'm a little slow here. Mute is off. Okay, there I did. All right. Mm-hmm. Actually, we have a number of questions for you, but I'm going to wait and see if others have questions or comments.
All the hippopotamuses first. My goodness, no hippopotamuses. All right. Now all the martyred virgins.
Really?
And hippopotamuses. And hippopotamuses also.
Maharaj, although this isn't directly related to your class, but we had a big discussion last night, and we were kind of waiting for today's class in order to bring this up so you could
shed
more light in it. Okay.
I hope so.
It's not exactly related here. There's the four states of consciousness, waking, dreaming, deep sleep, and then transcendence.
Yeah.
One devotee was pointing out that even though those are higher states of consciousness gradually evolving to the fourth stage, Turiya, you would think that dreaming and deep sleep, just like when you're under anesthesia, that puts you more in the mode of ignorance. So it's kind of confusing, because in one sense, you're going to more and more subtle levels of consciousness, or in other words, you're getting closer and closer to the fourth stage. But at the same time, it seems like you're going from wakefulness to sleep, deep sleep. That's going more in the motivator.
And so somebody, you're moving, somebody moving their microphone or something, or getting a lot of noise, like, you know, microphone motion. I had the same question. Of course, I'm a psychologist, so my nature is asked that same question. And these states are identified in psychology, you know, the dreaming state and the deep sleeping state. I think it's just the way it goes, is that the grossest state is when we become completely absorbed into the gross existence, and at that point the ego dissolves. You know, this is the point that Prabhupada said. He says, I don't like the word. Is there somebody moving your microphone like that or something? There's all this kind of noise there. Maybe not. Maybe it's just this background noise of somebody.
I think I see who it is. Just one.
Okay. You got it. You got the criminal. you killed him and didn't kill him at the same time. With your sharp intelligence. Okay. Yeah. The Prabhupada in his commentary on Jung's ideas says, I don't like the word unconscious. Why unconscious? And Carl Jung says the same thing. He says, for somebody it's unconscious, for somebody else it's quite conscious, you know. It's a very interesting thing, you know. But that, in the dreaming state, okay, the dreams are like in between. You know, these are things that are subtle things, and it's not that it's just like there's a sharp boundary and it's one or the other. When we start to go more and more deeply into the dreams, we start to go into more and more, you know, deeper kinds of things that exist in the material world, like that. And maybe we can go left and right and not just up and down, you know. And so, at some point, though, yeah, the dreams are not there. There's no more rapid eye movement in the person, and that point is called deep sleep, and the person has no memories of it. And so that's where the subconscious is there. And Prabhupada doesn't like unconscious. It's not that you can't become conscious of that. So it appears from psychologists and also from Prabhupada that a pure devotee, purified devotee, he pulls into himself so much, he's like a diamond, that even when he goes into the unconscious state, he can be conscious of it, you know, and remember it or something like that, from a spiritual level like that. So what goes on exactly, who knows? But yeah, it's the state of being absorbed, according to the psychologists also, into the most gross aspects of the material world. And then when you come back to the dreaming level, then there's some order to the thing in terms of, you know, consciousness, civilization. And then finally, when you come to conscious life, of course, you know, that can also be a nightmare. You know, and you can also experience these different states, dreams, hysteria. Hallucination. You can also have, you know, hallucinations while supposedly your eyes are open, you're sitting around with everybody else, you know. So you're in the dreaming state within and experiencing different levels. So what I understand is like that. It's just the exact opposite, that the sushupti, when everything is just dissolved, is the grossest state usually. Shupti, the dreaming state, is a little bit more organized. We have choices, and finally jagra or something. Then you're awake and you actually can start dealing with things as a human being, yeah? and make choices and understand spiritual life. And then finally, turiya is the state where you're actually aware of the spiritual existence. Okay? So it seems it's going like the opposite direction, but that's why I understand the fourth one is above waking consciousness, not below deep sleep.
In regards to this and some other things, we have about three more questions, but I'm going to wait to see if others have questions. Okay, if nobody's speaking up, then the other question that came up in regards to this was, what is the purpose of dream, and how can we become free, you know, of dreams? In other words, a saintly person needs much less sleep, you know, exactly are his dreams or what are the purpose of dreams? These were the kind of questions that were coming up that we're saving for you to see what you had to say.
Wow, what is the purpose of dreams? Working all this kind of stuff, you know. According to Carl Jung, who's appreciated by Prabhupada but other people, the subconscious material cannot manifest itself properly. You know, and I'm reading this stuff. It's helping me a lot, just in making my own life a little bit more sane. You know, because I'm an extremely intellectual person. Okay. And it happens to women and men, everybody else. There's some people, like Carl Jung says, basically a head with little wings on it, floating, flying around. And he's a very funny guy, where you can get into things, you know. And then the other hand is that somebody has no, man or woman who has no contact with their, what's the word, sympathetic system, their body and what's happening and stuff, you know. So this guy may having, one that was patients, was having this repeated dream of like being attacked by a crab, you know, over some idea about climbing a mountain. And it was obvious to him as anything that the guy had come from a very low class, simple family. He'd become the professor of a leader of a big high school. Now he wanted to become like, you know, a professor in a big university. And the guy had really overreached himself because of his pride and arrogance. He really wanted to do something which is not really going to be possible in that lifetime. And to do it, even become the president of the, they call it the principal of the high school, he had to force his body, you know, so much to do things that were unnatural to him, that the body was starting to complain. So the crab, he says, usually represents the stomach and that kind of nervous system. You know, and so the guy didn't accept that. He was very intellectual. Oh, Dr. Freud can't understand. He's trying to limit me. I will do this and that. And so Freud said, all right, you know, then go ahead. And within 3 months, the guy was a complete collapse, you know, so on like that. So sometimes in the end, we shouldn't be, you know, try to eliminate the dreams. We should look at them, and especially if they're recurring, and many times they bring in content which the subconscious is trying to tell us about something. Hey, Baba, this is as high as you should try and go. Calm down, have a good life. And just try and take care of your natural inclinations now from your birth, you know. And other than that, we as devotees, you know, as Prabhupada says about, work hard all day with the animals and the agriculture, drink sufficient hot milk, hear the Krishna book with your family, and dream about Krishna, like that. So there's no problem having nice dreams about Krishna, about going to Goloka. I mean, if Krishna can manifest in the taste of water and the light of the sun, yeah, he can also manifest in very specific, you know, forms, pastimes, leelas. Again, Jayananda said that. Prabhupada said, if you go on chanting Hare Krishna, you'll see forms you never, you know, pastimes you never read in any of my books. So we shouldn't be opposed to our dreams and thoughts and stuff about Krishna. And Prabhupada, of course, you know, says he felt Bhakti Siddhanta came to him in a dream. And I would suspect Prabhupada other times too had mentioned that. You know, he was also quite appreciative of his dreams and what happened. But we should always interpret them in terms of, you know, our guru, the Saintly Association of Devotees, and this real standard revelation in the Bhagavatam about different things like that, you know. And then, yeah, they're real. They're just as real as the gross world. But sometimes, yeah, they can be a real source of help for getting our character together. And other than that, maybe, you know, Krishna is trying to talk to us. Or maybe it's just when our ghost body has to shut down, like this fever I had the last few days, yeah. And I was in my mind, and I was, see, I'm actually improving. Well, it was the last time I had a fever like this, maybe 3 years ago. Because now I was able to channel my fingers. I couldn't even move the beads, but I was able to channel my fingers and keep any images in my mind to help that and go with it. And I'm making progress. I'm not ready to die yet. So but really, really making progress over where I was 3 years ago. So that's what I understand.
There's another question came in, but again, Prabhu, does anyone else have anything they would like?
I just want one thought on dreams. You know, why do we dream?
Yeah.
Well, it's a perverted reflection in one sense of the spiritual world. Krishna dreams. The residents of the spiritual world dream. Therefore, when we come to this world, we also dream.
Yeah. He talks about how the cowherd men would sleep soundly and dream about all the things that happen. They would, the daydreams or night dreams, there's no difference. So the gopis would always be thinking about Krishna. Everybody in Vrindavan would always be thinking about their pastimes. And they were always in three levels, the Brijbasis. Then there's this dream level, this intimate association with their confidential circle, and publicly carrying on the life of Vrindavan.
I don't remember in what context, but in somewhere in Prabhupada's books, Prabhupada mentions briefly, and I've only seen it once in one reference to it, that sometimes material desires are exhausted or fulfilled in dreams.
Yeah, okay.
Where is that reference?
I'm not going to share my screen here. What's happening here? Close that off. Let's go to google.com. This would be the best browser there. Okay. Let's go to my webpage.
I think that's in the introduction book.
Let me go to... maybe there. But I think it's in Bhagavatam also.
I think it's in the Bhagavatam.
This is our webpage. And if you go to the archives, okay, it tells you about how our archives are a big mess, but there's some order to them. Okay. And this will take you to the actual archives. And here they are in alphabetical order. And you go down to American Bhagavad Curriculum, index.doc. This is the index we set up. Okay. I click on that, it should load it. And okay. And here it is. And I think maybe if I click on dreams here. It's in the control click, right? Enable editing. Yeah. Okay, nothing under dreams there. Go back to the top. Because I remember the same one, and when I'm doing this with all this time for, because I also wanted to like see if I had it. And this is the updated version of our index. It's an old one. Okay, so I can't remember where it is right away. Maybe it'd be under karma. This is an old version of the index. I'll update this. Because you've been updating it as you're doing the Bhakti Baba thing. No, I don't see anything. Okay. Because it's a nice citation. Prabhupada says that sometimes a devotee will have inauspicious dreams. Like he may have dreams of having sex with one of your parents or something. It's so disgusting, you know. But why is that? Because we still have those desires, and if we're going to fulfill them, you can't fulfill them in a human body, you know. So therefore, you're going to have to take birth in an animal body to do that. So Prabhupada says, therefore, to shortcut the process, Krishna many, many times allows the devotee to experience these things in dreams. And therefore, he says, one should not be so disturbed, you know, by these kind of things like that. Krishna? Okay. That's all I can think of, yeah. Yeah, but I can't find the reference right away. Yeah.
I'll poke along while you're speaking. I'll poke around a little bit in the Veda base, see if I can find
it. Oh, if you find
reference.
It, yeah. Yeah, many hands make light work.
Marge, another question came in about you began your lecture referring to how the Pandavas, Draupadi, and Arjuna, then they performed the funeral rites for the departed sons. So if someone is asking, where can we find directions for the rituals that one should perform for deceased relatives?
As far as I know, those come from the Hari Bhakti Vilas. I don't know if Krishna Kshetra Prabhu, I guess they're not, maybe they're in the deity worship book or not, you know. But devotees like that, like Krishna Kshetra Prabhu, the ministry of deity worship, I think they're also expanding their activities into that. So what's his name? From Australia. Oh my God, Nishinga Kavachi. Nishinga Kavachi. Probably if you look on the ISKCON website, he'll show up. But I don't know them. But they're probably from the Hari Bhakti Vilas, and those are excessively ritualistic. Prabhupada says. So probably coming down from our acharyas, they've given us a more practical process which works. The basic thing, as I know, is of course, you know, the body should be burned, and Prabhupada in Nectar of Devotion says for a certain number of days certain people shouldn't enter the temple, you know, so on. And then after that, a certain number of days, there should be a Shraddha ceremony with a picture, and we have nice kirtan, talk about the person, you know, and then offer Mahaprasad to them, and a kirtan. And that's basically a simple idea that Prabhupada gave us for the process. But Nishinga Kavacha, he actually teaches that now. They actually teach that in Mayapur.
Okay. Boy, it's been amazingly quiet today. Don't hear devotees. Anyone else?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, that was a really enlightening class. It was just a really great class.
Oh, thank you. I don't do them.
You just say so many interesting things about Sanskrit and everything. You tie it all together. It's just great. But about dreams, I've been in college recently and took a lot of psychology classes, and one of the things I learned is that dreams are our subconscious mind categorizing what happened during the day so that we'll have a memory of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, the mind during the day is getting so much bombarded by so much stuff, information, and then at night we process it so that we can remember it in categories like it.
It's interesting, too, because like a daughter remembers or something like that, a princess, one of these Ronnies, you know, she's like 80 years old or something, when she wrote the book, she was 55, she's remembering, like, you know, what it was to be the daughter of a Raja and stuff, and I think even under the British rule. But they were very sophisticated people, very trained. So one night she was saying goodnight to her father, And she said, I won't be able to sleep because I have so many things to think about. So many things happened today. He told her, no. He said, you should have done that earlier. Now it's time to sleep. You should stop that and go to sleep. So these people didn't have to do it because they had time every day to stop and go back over the day's activities and think about them, sort them out, you know, and then to remember the things that were supposed to be remembered, and then actually even consciously not remember the things they didn't want to remember. It's interesting, but we don't do that, so our subconscious has to kind of do it for us, you know.
Also, I found this passage in Krishna book, The Advent of Lord Krishna, so it's the first chapter, I guess. This body is exactly like one of the bodies which we always see in dreams. During our dream of sleep, we create so many bodies according to imagination. We have seen gold, and we have also seen a mountain. So in a dream, we can see a golden mountain by combining the two ideas. Sometimes in dreams, we see that we have a body which is flying in the sky, and at that time, we completely forget our present body. Similarly, these bodies are changing.
Wow. Yeah, so again, more than one lifetime. And again, sometimes too, it's just, yeah, I mean, Dhritarashtra, was he able to get free from it all in one lifetime? Personal associate of Krishna. Incredibly good karma, incredibly good person in many ways. But he had some things that were very deep, very deep. Some of them for apparently for hundred lifetimes to deal with. So we think, Haribol Prabhu, going to take care of this. Yeah, with the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, you got a big hammer, you know. But maybe you also got a big wall to break down more than other people, you know. So, and you get discouraged and you don't become a sincere devotee anymore. I mean, what's the word? Enthusiastic devotee of chant arounds for all principles. If you're not like enthusiastic and fired up because you're just not making much progress, don't be that way. You know, you may have bigger problems than somebody else of chant and everything else. And then, like Arjuna, get close to Krishna and start making these big decisions. I guess we should go, though, our 12:45, and get ready for our next project here. But it's been so nice. This is the end of the chapter, and next is, of course, the birth of Pariksha. I guess the next one is when Vidura comes back. No. I don't know what's next. It's chapter 7, 8. Kunti. Chapter 8 is Kunti's prayers. I'm trying to keep Krishna from escaping, like that. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Maharaj. It's a shame actually you didn't get a chance to go over the summary of the chapter. It looks like you put a lot into that. It's really interesting. But anyway.
Well, it was good for me. Whatever work I put into it, I certainly got the benefit also. But basically, that's it. It's just that. This is really important because you're trying to Suta Goswami is really trying to impress upon us the circumstances, you know, that Srimad Bhagavatam is not an ordinary book. These are not ordinary people, and it's not an ordinary situation in which it was spoken. So listen. Okay, thank you very, very much. Hare Krishna, all glory to Srila Prabhupada.
All glory to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you very much.
Namaste, Maharaj.
Ah, it's devotees from Australia. Australia, devotees from Guam are there. I see one devotee born on Guam. Yeah. And devotees from Australia. Hare Krishna.
Okay, Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.